Hello and welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I am here with Martin in decent health condition, Willis.
Wow. I hope that continues.
I know, I do too, and the reason I mention it is because it's a bit rare. Lately, you've been falling off of stuff, you've been getting sick, I mean... You know, you've had concussions and all this crazy stuff, but you're doing all right right now.
It's been a year, but I want to tell you, your listeners. Mm-hmm. I want to thank your listeners.
Really,
so many people reach out to me after our last show when I talked about falling off the roof, and I thought that was very nice of them.
Oh, did they? What did they say?
You know, just basically stay off ladders and, you know, we need you. All some really nice things.
So, oh, that's anyway. Good. It yeah. wasn't like nice fall, no. catchy next spring or something like that.
No, or, you know, please land on your head next time. Nothing like that.
Yeah, that's yeah. good. Yeah, yeah, my listeners in particular, I know you've got some good listeners. Yeah. But mine are about as good as they get. They're flipping awesome. I met a few at the conference, I always do, and it's these are just cool people. I'm always impressed with the quality of people that listen to this show.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I feel the same way.
Well, that was really nice of them, and I'm so happy that you're in good health and doing well, just braving the cold. That's all you're up to, huh?
That's right, yeah.
Good.
I'm ready for spring. It's the first day of spring.
Yeah, that's right. Happy first day of spring. I guess from what I've seen, because, you know, they make up these, it's this day, it's that day all the time. Today is Alien Abduction Day. Did you know that?
No. Do they know that?
Aliens?
Yeah, hope not.
I don't. Yeah. They might have registered it. They might have submitted. Hey, I mean... They're the authorities. They're the ones who should determine what day is Alien Abduction Day. So I hope someone consulted with them, and they said, yeah, today's the day we abduct the heck out of people. And March 20th, first day of spring, it's always a good day to celebrate. Maybe that's how they celebrate.
Yeah, could be.
It's kind of their spring celebration.
It's kind of opposite of the harvest in the fall.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Interesting.
So yeah, I don't know. That I guess that's just what that is. But the show today, my interview, is a fun one. So this is a gentleman named Ray Shemansky. Have you ever heard of him?
No.
He wrote a book called 50 Shades of Grey's Evidence of Extraterrestrial Visitation to Wright Patterson and Beyond. And he comes to the conference all the time, the UFO Congress, and I've seen him around. I've seen him post stuff on Facebook and stuff like this. But, yeah, he finally wrote a book. And this is what's interesting about him, which I didn't know prior, is he has been like an engineer at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for 30-some-odd years.
Wow.
Yeah, how cool is that? So, and a lot of the people he's worked with are into UFOs.
Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, we hear so much about all of this. So we talked to him about that. We talked to him about what got him interested. and, you know, Wright-Patterson, of course. But we talk about his book, and his book is more than Wright-Patterson. It's essentially just about how a skeptical senior engineer at Wright-Patterson came to believe that there's aliens. So, and it's an interesting, you know, path, and the book sounds really good. I actually met him. He works with a bit with Yvonne Smith, at least he was helping her with her table at our conference. And so in exchange, she let him sell the books there at her table. So, yeah, so that's a story.
Well, it'll be an interesting one.
Yeah, yep. So really great guy. So this is going to be a fun interview. But before we do that, you and I always discuss UFOs in the news, UFO news.
That's right.
So what you got for me, buddy?
All right. So this story is about a disc UFO caught on camera moving out of the bay. And this is I think it's Port Greville. I may be pronouncing that totally wrong. It's in Canada. I think near the Bay of Fundy, on the East Coast. So, it was a disc shaped object. And what had happened was the witness was, at a friend's house. It is on the Bay of Fundy in Nova Scotia, and staying on a beach cottage back in August 6 of 2016. And he was watching in a fairly intense, lightning storm roll into the mouth of the bay in the Atlantic. And, you know, they were out there barbecuing and all that. So he started filming, and he was filming this, and he filmed also a double strike of lightning. That was the most exciting one. He said, you know, he heard an immediate loud bang when that happened. And of course that could have been from a strike before. So he put his camera away, they ate supper and all that stuff, until 2 or 3 days later, he was going and, watching the video. And he really saw nothing. And then he hit, hit pause during one of the lightning strikes and took a screenshot for Facebook. And scrolling backwards very slowly, he started taking different screenshots. And then he got to the very first few seconds of the video, and he could see a disc-like object. He calls it the size of a semi-trailer, but I don't know how he could possibly judge that, saying that's, from a film. And not being there and actually seeing it in person, and even seeing it in person, it'd be hard to judge the size. Mm-hmm. But it came flying out of the bay, according to him, at an angle, and it does look like it's going at an angle if you look at the pictures that are included. And he said it seemed to, like, shoot off. And so he went through all these screenshots, and he says he has unbelievable video and unbelievable pictures, and he's like, in this article, he's like, I've spent 8 months seeking help and getting nowhere, and I pray you people take me seriously and show some interest because this is real. That's kind of his statement in the about this report. So he reported it to a field investigator, David Delaney, and along with these five images. And so anyway, I thought it was, it's a pretty good looking whatever it is. And to me, I can't think, you know, a lot of times you see things like this in a blur and it could be a bird, but this is very elongated. I don't think it could be in any type of way it could be a bird. And what is your thoughts on that? Did you take a look at it?
I have. And it's interesting you say it's good looking. That's a good looking whatever it is. Flew out of bay. But there have been some comments lately, and I do kind of feel it could be a bird or bug moving quickly in comparison to how many frames were being snapped. So like a motion blur kind of effect. It seems like maybe more likely be a bug than a bird, because like you said, it's so thin and moving quickly. And it would be then it closer. So all we have are stills from this alleged video and not the video itself. So it's hard to determine whether or not it came out of the water. So without further information, I would have to think this might be a bug. Although I could be wrong, and they are interesting images because giving the images on face value, it looks like a, you know, long cigar-shaped UFO type of thing. And they're neat pictures because there's a storm in the background and there's a lightning strike in one of the images and some clouds in the background, which I guess would give you a little bit of an idea. I mean, it seems like these clouds and this rain is happening in the lake or the bay there, not too far, certainly closer than the other side of the bay, which would mean this object has to be closer than that. So at least that gives it so it's probably not too far. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it can't be too far if it is further away. But, it's possible. It's very close, and a bug flying through the screen. So hard to say.
It wouldn't be the first time, that's for sure. I mean, you think of the one in Denver that was on the news that ended up being bugs, and also the one in Chile at that, during an Air Force show or whatever it was.
Yeah.
That ended up just being plain bugs, but you're right about
plain
the video. It would be good
bugs
to actually see it. Mm. Mm-hmm. And they do seem to, when they're near the camera, of course, they're moving really fast.
Yeah.
So it does look like something moving very fast as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So interesting, but yeah, it's hard to say on that one. So a couple other things in the news today. That are kind of interesting. We've got this in our headlines, but a couple cool ones I wanted to mention. One of them is our witnesses from a Melbourne High School UFO sighting. So this is the Westall sighting. So years ago, and I think it was in the 80s, and this is a bummer. So if you click on the link, it's the Herald Sun, you're going to be able to see the article. Unless the Herald Sun is somewhere you go, because it's one of these things where it's a pay site, and they only let you look at one story before you have to pay for them. So you can go look at the story, but if you've done like me and already clicked on the link, it's not going to let you look at it anymore. But it was a cool story, and I'll need to try to get access and then cut and paste it, maybe get on it, because they talked to several of the witnesses from this really famous case where this craft came down over this park near a high school, and there were a bunch of witnesses. It's a great case.
Oh, yes.
And so they've talked to these witnesses since it's an anniversary of this sighting. So really cool article. So if you could see that, you'll find that on our front page. Another cool article is a police sighting. So this is from the Great Falls Tribune, and it's kind of their police blotter page, and they talk about a few things going on, including a UFO that was spotted by three sheriff deputies and several others. So let me read this, because it's just a short paragraph. So this is one of the paragraphs in this whole blotter story, where they have a paragraph on several different incidents that happened. But this one says, a new unidentified flying object sighting was made by three sheriff's deputies and several others Thursday night, according to a report filed Friday. Under Sheriff Frank Takala said the object hovered north and west of Gore Hill. The report said the UFO was yellow in color and seemed to emit a red glow from top and bottom. After remaining motionless in an overcast and starless night, it traveled west and disappeared. The undersheriff said it appeared to be about six times as large as the largest star that can be seen on a clear night. UFOs were also reported near Vaughan, Fort Benton, and Chateau on Tuesday night.
Wow, so very active, huh?
Yeah, that's kind of cool, though. This is a sighting report from some police.
And how did you stumble across? Did this somehow just go viral, or how did you find this?
Oh, this is how I find my normal headlines that I find every day. My proprietary news UFO headline search.
I see.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, yeah. So, that one eventually you know, may become something that you even see in the British tabloids, the way that they must be doing the same thing.
Oh, yeah, they do. But they also take advantage of my site, and they let me do the work for them. And they'll also often post and get their facts wrong on Roger stories. Or, you know, they probably do the same thing. But I know they do look at our site, and you can too. So if you go to openminds.tv, you'll see every day, or at least every weekday, we update the UFO headlines, which you see there right on the front page, and that's where you'll see these stories listed. But how cool is that? That's really cool. I love it when police and stuff.
Oh, I know. You know, and it's funny. Reports. I've talked to skeptics before that, well, a particular skeptic that said that they make no better observer than anyone else, and I don't believe that. I disagree with that.
Yeah.
I think they do make a really good observer.
Oh, and most definitely.
One of the reasons I feel that way. Yeah, one of the reasons I feel that way is because they'd be reluctant to report something.
Yeah.
You know, it's a career killer.
Yeah, and they get calls on these sort of things. Mm-hmm. It's like us, you know, you and I, we're not going to be the best observers, but we're going to be better just because we pay attention to these sort of things on a daily basis.
Right.
A police officer also, you know, they get calls on these sorts of things, and so they have to figure things out, so... So yeah, I think they're going to be a good reporter, and a pilot especially. Come on, they're looking out of their window, they're seeing objects in the sky constantly. So yeah, when the skeptics say, you know, they're not good reporters, I think that's kind of silly.
Especially if you get a pilot that has a military background as well. You
exactly.
know what I mean? Compounding.
Mm-hmm. So good stuff. You got anything else?
I think that's it for me today.
Okay, cool. Well, good. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. As you know, my audience and myself are very happy that you're in good health and you haven't damaged yourself or gotten sick.
Yeah, I'll try to keep going that way.
Yeah, keep it this way, young man.
All right. Hey, thanks a lot.
All right.
Fun as always.
Yep, so let's go ahead and talk to Ray Shemansky. I am happy to welcome Ray Shemansky to the show. Hello, how are you?
I'm doing great, Alejandro. How about yourself?
Not too bad. All rested for the weekend. Some allergies on this first day of spring, but other than that, pretty well.
Good to hear.
So what part of the country are you in?
I'm in the Dayton, Ohio area. I sit about 3 or 4 miles from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Okay, so you're still out there, which is where you formerly worked, or do you still work there?
No, I retired in September of 2011 due to a traffic wreck that I had, and it was time to go.
Mm-hmm. All right, and now you're doing UFOs. So how did you get into UFOs?
That's a really interesting question. It was 1973, and I came down to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base as a cooperative education student from the University of Detroit. So it's January, it's bleak here in the Midwest, and I was assigned to a gentleman that I can only refer to as Corvette Al, as in the Corvette Stingray, because he owned one of those, and he was pretty proud of it. But he was my mentor, and during the first week of my assignment, we were sitting in Building 22, which is, at that time, two business office buildings about 2 stories tall with a large 200-foot empty hangar sitting in between them. And he said, hey, why don't we go to the Greasy Spoon, which is on the other side of the hangar, and we'll get you a candy bar, kind of, you know, introduce you to Wright-Patterson. So my mentor and I step out of the first business office into this vast empty hangar that housed nothing but spiders and spider webs, and we step into this hangar, and he says, have you heard about our aliens? Now, I'm a co-op student from the University of Detroit. I don't even know what the word alien means at that time. So I say, well, no, I haven't. And he said, well, you know, we have aliens here at Wright-Patterson. There was a crash out west. They brought the bodies and the materials here. They've been examined here, and everybody knows about it. And I said, well, geez, that's interesting. Can we go see these aliens? He says, well, they're in the tunnels. I said, well, let's go see the aliens in the tunnels. And he says, well, we can't really do that because it's a secret.
Mm-hmm. And this
so
was,
I said, yes?
This was like your first day at the base?
My very first week at Wright-Patterson Air Force
Base.
Wow.
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
So he is telling me that we've got aliens in the tunnels. We can't see them because they're special. And when I mentioned the word secret a third time in the conversation, apparently I had exceeded some limit of using that word in a conversation. And he said, hey, look at the time. Let's go back to the office. But that's when my interest in UFOs and extraterrestrials got spawned the very first week that I was working there.
Mm-hmm. And did you suspect at all he was screwing around with you, like, you know, kind of like first week where you mess with the new guy type of thing?
Yeah, I thought it was a fraternity hazing going on.
Mm-hmm.
But what I did is I checked with coworkers that I got to know and I got to trust in that first 3 month period. And I'd ask them, I go, hey, I was told that we have these aliens in the tunnels. What do you know? And to a person, they would go, oh, yeah. Yeah, of course we have them. And the interesting background is, you know, this is 1973, and so Blue Book had just ended less than a handful of years prior to that in 1969. So UFOs and extraterrestrials and Project Blue Book was in the DNA of everybody who worked on the base, and it seemed like everyone was aware of that past history of Project Blue Book having been there and the investigative team having been there, and it was always in local newspapers and there were TV shows about it. So it just was a matter of fact acceptance that, oh yeah, we had them, you know, from the Roswell crash.
Wow. And I think people will know, most of the listeners, but for any who do not yet, Wright-Patterson is where the official UFO investigations of the United States Air Force from 47 to 69 took place.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. And then there are also rumors that the Roswell craft was taken there along with bodies and that they were held in some special room.
That's also true. And if you look at the history, look at Jesse Marcel was the first Air Force person to touch the materials that were recovered because he drove out there a couple days after the rancher Mac Brazel came in with the materials. And in the late 70s, Jesse Marcel was interviewed by Stanton Friedman, and Marcel made it perfectly plain that, one, the materials were not of this earth, and two, they were taken to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And Jesse Marcel had absolutely no reason whatsoever to put out this information because he didn't benefit from it. So here's a guy who was an intelligence officer who knew everything that flew for the Air Force at that time, and he said it wasn't of this planet, and it went to Wright-Patterson. So I think that's pretty good confirmation that whatever it was did come to the base.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, did you pursue this? You continued then, it sounds like, to work at that base for many, many years.
Yeah, I actually worked at Wright-Patterson for 38 years and 9 months.
Wow.
And when I left there, I was a senior scientist slash engineer, so a high-level GS 14. Mm-hmm. And so when I got interested in it, you know, you kind of let it go because no one's really talking about it. They're not giving you any information. Nobody's really seen the aliens. Nobody has really handled the crash records. It was impossible to try to get that information, but it was always in the back of my mind. So every time I'd go into a new place that had maybe highly classified research programs or management programs, I always kept my eyes open and my ears open for maybe a little factoid that might come my way.
Mm-hmm. And so did anything come your way?
Well, there were always hints and tidbits, but nobody actually showed me the aliens, if that's what you're asking.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, did you have any similar conversations to that first one afterwards?
Oh, many. With the people that I work with eventually, if you would go through the office space, I worked for Air Force Research Labs for almost my entire career. And what you would find in the offices were these 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper, and you'd find on it the Air Force UFO identification chart. And on there would be photographs, not a photograph, but an outline of, say, something from Star Trek or the Klingon ship or some standard shaped disc or the B-2. And under each one of those, it would say weather balloon, weather balloon, weather balloon.
Mm-hmm.
And that, then it was a picture of a weather balloon, and underneath it, it would say swamp gas.
Yeah, so I've seen that photo online.
Well, so it actually was a knock against the Air Force's, you know, now 70 years of denial of that incident happening. But you found those kinds of things just throughout all the offices, and it was kind of like the person was identifying themselves as somebody who was interested in the phenomena, but let you know in a subtle way by posting that in their cubicle.
Mm-hmm. Did you have conversations with others there who said, yes, I'm aware of the aliens, or I know the aliens are down there?
Again, people had studied the issue, and they were convinced that if there were aliens and if there was a crash wreckage, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base would have been the place to take it because we had top scientists in the field. We had funding. We had people who had their security clearances. We had equipment. We had facilities. We had contracts. We had contractors. So we had all the elements necessary, including the expertise, which is extremely important, to do the evaluation of whatever was recovered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. So that's what got you into all this. So while you were working at Wright-Patterson, were you doing your own research regarding UFOs and getting involved with UFO organizations?
I started reading every book that I could get my hands on. I started with the local library and then branched out to other libraries and trading books, that kind of thing. So dozens and dozens and dozens of books. And then, of course, with the advent of the internet and all the information that was available there, my voracious appetite took over and I kept doing more and more reading. And then in about 2008, I found myself right near Exeter, New Hampshire. And I decided for some strange reason, I wanted to go visit Exeter. I wanted to prove to myself that what was in John's Fuller's book, Incident at Exeter, was actually true. So I spent a couple of days there, a couple of evenings there. I did some research. I found some new witnesses who told me some new things that were not published in the book. Some of these things are published in my new book. And there's other things that I also know from the witnesses I talked to I didn't publish upon their request. But that initial field investigation really got me excited about the topic because there was so much proof that was available even, you know, 40 or 50 years after the incident, which happened in 1965, that I thought, you know, I think there's something to this. So that first field investigation got me to thinking about doing more of that.
Mm-hmm. So, and then eventually you decided to write your own book. So tell us what, you know, perspective or angle you decided to take when you decided to tackle your own book.
Well, I had done the investigation at Exeter and it was pretty fruitful. I then went to Rendlesham in 2012. And I visited Rendlesham Forest. I did an investigation there. I talked to some of the principals, John Burroughs, Jim Penniston, Colonel Halt. I did my investigation there. Then I had an opportunity to go with Travis Walton to his site. And I did that in conjunction and the support of Jennifer Stein, who had just wrapped the movie Travis.
Mm-hmm.
And I had met her during the time where she won the Evie, and told her that, hey, I don't know exactly where the site is, but I'm going to do an investigation, and I know that I can get within 100 yards of the actual site based upon my years of research into the Travis Walton incident. And as luck would have it, she said, you know what? I need somebody to go up there and shoot some photographs for me, some stills, to go into a newly edited version of the movie Travis, and I want you to get these tree stumps that shows the large growth on the side of the trees that were facing the direction of the craft that took Travis away. And I said, yeah, I can do that. But again, I'm only going to get, you know, within a hand grenade distance. And she said, hey, I know someone who might be able to help you. Next thing I know, she's calling Travis Walton over.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, hey, Travis, I want you to go with Ray here up to the site, and he's going to shoot some photographs for me for insertion in our movie. And a couple of days later, Travis and I were standing on the site of his I'll call it an abduction, although he wouldn't call it an abduction, his disappearance, his incident. And it's funny because during that visit, Travis just stopped cold and he starts pointing and he says, you know, that's the road that we were driving up. And we drove up this road and we saw this fiery light up here where we're standing. And I jumped out of the car and he starts to explain the entire incident to me. And it was at that point that I decided that I had something with my Exeter research and Rendlesham research and this moment with Travis Walton, plus what I knew about Wright-Patterson, that I said, I think this stuff needs to go in a book.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the seminal moment of, hey, I've got something here. I think I need to share it.
How cool. So just for people, and most people know, because we cover a lot of Travis stuff. Luckily, he's here in Arizona, so I talk to him a lot. We've got a lot of videos. But, of course, this is the guy, for those who aren't aware, who was with some colleagues, some fellow loggers, back in, what was it, 74?
1975, November 5th.
Oh, 5. And they saw this craft in the forest. It beamed Travis some, and he went missing for several days. You could look up more at OpenMinds.tv or many other places. They did the movie Fire in the Sky based off of Travis's experience. But Exeter, maybe if you could kind of summarize for people what happened there.
Okay, in September of 1965, a young man, he was 19 years old, his name was Norman Muscarello, and he was making his way towards Exeter, New Hampshire, coming up Route 150, and he was doing so because he was coming from a friend's house, he had no car, he was hitchhiking, and as he was hitchhiking, he got in front of a residence that was owned by Clyde Russell. It was a farm. And he got in front of this house, and the next thing you know, from the back part of the property, up came a 90-foot craft, a glowing craft that had lights that would go 1, 2, 3, 4 to the right, and then to the left, 4, 3, 2, 1. And there was this alternating light that Norman eventually described to John Fuller and others. Well, it was no more than 100 foot off the ground, and Norman thought he was going to be crushed, so he drops down behind his stone wall, decides there's no protection there, stumbles across the road, falls into a narrow ditch. At that point, the 90-foot craft, which Norman referred to as that thing, he mm-hmm. always called it that thing, it recedes back to the back of the property. At that point, he goes onto the Russell porch, raps on the door, nobody answers. And he jumps back onto the road. Somebody picks him up. They take him into Exeter, where a desk sergeant by the name of Reginald Scratch Tolan is sitting. Scratch listens to a story, shakes his head, but he knows Norman is not the kind of person who struck the fantasy. So when Officer Eugene Bertrand comes in, Tolan says, hey, I want you to take Norman back out to the site, see what you can see. So they go back and they park the cruiser between the Carl Dining Farm and the Russell Farm, and they go out into the fields because on the dining farm, they hear all the livestock going insane. The horses are kicking holes in their barns. The dogs are barking. And a few minutes later, that thing shows up again and hovers over Officer Bertrand and Norman Muscarello. So Officer Bertrand pulls out his revolver, gets down on one knee, aims it at the thing, and then decides, nah, we're not going to do this today. And as they retreat out of that farmer's field, a second officer by the name of David Hunt pulls up in his patrol car. And while all three of them are standing there, they watch that thing go off to the east and disappear somewhere over the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really interesting story. And they felt the young man was very honest. Obviously, they had their own sighting. So, and I think, yeah, so he was, it's a small town, right? So they knew him and they felt everyone involved was credible. So
And it had been seen by others. It had hovered over individuals' cars. It had stopped their cars. They had those electrical problems. It had gone over the Air Force base. And so this was not a one-time incident. That UFO had actually hung around the area for about a month. And all of that information, all of the contact, all of the sightings are in John Fuller's book.
Mm-hmm. So you say you began as kind of a skeptic, but over time, you know, you became, as your bio says, a firm believer in the ET hypothesis. Is that kind of what the book is, a journey of your discovery and research?
That's a perfect description. It was my quest to determine whether or not there was any truth to what I had heard at Wright-Patterson for all those years, and my general curiosity about the phenomena. Is there anything to it? And so I started out investigating three of the best documented cases, those that I think had the highest probability of answering my question. So Exeter, Rendlesham Forest, and Travis Walton. And there was a lot of documentation out there. Those were sites that I could visit. There were people still living that actually had information. When I went to Exeter, I found, that the man that was living in the Clyde Russell home was his 80-year-old son, Arthur Russell.
Hmm.
And Arthur Russell took me around Exeter and introduced me to people who were alive and knew about what was going on in Exeter in 1965, including a gentleman who owned the dining farm, who confirmed for me that indeed that night the horses actually destroyed their stalls.
Wow.
through the kicking process. So not only were they, you know, did Fuller say, yeah, that they went nuts, but this gentleman owned the farm, owned those stalls, and told me, yeah, he saw the damage. And, so it's like a little further confirmation of what was out there.
Mm-hmm. How cool. I think those are great cases to choose also, because one, you have a very credible sighting with Exeter, more kind of along the lines of the everyday sighting that people have out there, because people have extraordinary sightings on a regular basis, but usually it's anecdotal. But and then moving to Rendlesham, where you have just the credibility of the witnesses rise, and they have a little bit more interaction on a military base with something strange. And then your piece de resistance is Walton, where he actually allegedly interfaced with some creatures. But like you said, another very credible case in that there are multiple witnesses. And you, having spoke with Travis and gone to the site, I've spent a lot of time with him, including going to the site. But every time is similar to what you described, in that there's a genuine excitement that happens when he really gets into talking about the event or going to the site. And when he starts to point out details, you know, those details, at least for me, I've not found it changed at all over the years. Is that what you found with Travis?
Well, I had read the book. I saw the movie. Discussed the movie at length, and he claims it is a Hollywoodization. Of course, you know, the James Gardner character, for example, is a compilation of more than one law enforcement officer.
Right.
And of course, there's a lot of things that were misrepresented in the movie, but generally, you know, the story in three or four sentences is consistent. What I found with Travis is that when I encountered him as, you know, just the customer side of the table prior to writing this book, I found him to be very uncomfortable. He looked afraid of everybody, very, you know, and that's just the way he struck me, and he struck other people that way. But once I had him in my 4x4, and we were sliding up and down the mountains trying to get to a site because there was 3 inches of mud on the road, and we wound up jumping out. We saw a herd of wild horses, and we went out there to photograph them, and, you know, he jumped out of the car, and, you know, we're heading towards this wild herd of horses. You kind of get to see, you know, the humane side of him, the very non-Travis Walton, the abductee guy, but, you know, just Travis Walton, the normal, excited person living life. And that was, I think, the coolest part of me. That's what hearing some of his stories, his personal stories, it really built up a lot of credibility with me. And of course, I never doubted him because he had six witnesses that all passed lie detector tests. But it was so nice to see the non-abductee side of him and then being able to relate to that and incorporate that into my understanding of his story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people say, and I feel similar in that meeting him and interacting with him really is heightens the credibility in that, like you said, he seems really shy and wary of people. But as you spend more time with him, he loosens up. He just it's normal reactions that you would expect someone to have, I think, especially someone who lived in a rural area his whole life like he has, and is reticent to speak about a weird thing that happened that he doesn't understand, which, of course, is opening himself up, he knows, to criticism and everything. So, yeah, the genuineness of meeting and talking with him is one of the things that has a big impact on people. People typically feel better about the case after meeting and talking with him.
Yeah, if you look at the technical side of it, especially the fact that he had six guys who had no reason to make up a story like this, and then they all passed lie detector test, and the story has stood the test of time, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that the overall story is 100,000% true.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your journey, that first interaction you had, your first week at Wright-Patterson Air Force, probably was very impactful, really made you think and shocked you, I'm assuming.
Yeah, it did, because, you know, I'm just a kid from Detroit, and I don't know anything about aliens. I'm an engineering student. I'm focusing on math and science and, you know, provability. We're in the lab, and we're, you know, putting early circuits together, you know, in the 70s. So it was just, you know, anything that I can prove in the lab, I can measure it. And when, you know, you give me this concept of aliens, I had no idea where it was going. But I can tell you that in later years, and again, in the book, I actually address this. I discussed this with senior scientists. And in one of the events, you know who Art Campbell and Chuck Wade are, of course.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, I had met Art Campbell, and he and I got in this great conversation. I said, look, I've got some connections back at Air Force Research Labs, particularly in the materials directorate, and I've got this really crazy idea. What if I get a piece of the material that you guys uncovered on the plains of San Agustin, and I get it tested in the Air Force Materials Lab? Well, he looked at me like I had a third arm growing out of my ear. But he said, I'm game. So see what you can do. So what I did is I went back, and I actually had worked directly for the executive director of Air Force Research Lab. So he's the highest ranking civilian. And I know this guy was, you know, curious about the subject. So I said, hey, look, this guy claims that he uncovered this crash wreckage on the plains of San Agustin. It's already been tested. It's been shown to be isotopically different from what you might find on planet Earth. So here's a crazy idea. What if you use the old boy network and you tell them that I've got this material, and let's see if we can't do a backdoor testing at the materials directorate? Well, the first thing I expected him to do was like laugh me out of his office. But he said, that's a great idea. Now, mind you, this is the former executive director of Air Force Research Labs.
Wow.
So, you know, this tells you what the real Air Force is thinking. So I said, let's go for it. So what did he do? He contacts the former director of the materials directorate. This guy ran the whole shooting match. That guy said, let's go for it. And again, I'm making it through these wickets going, I'm in a dreamland here, because I thought they would just laugh me, you know, right out of their lives. Well, come to find out, they then engaged the people who were currently being able to make that decision at the materials directorate and told them everything and told them they thought it was not of this planet. Well, strange again, rather than being laughed, you know, right out of the room, they were told, we're going to consider it. And eventually they came back and said, we can't do it. We're backlogged, you know, for the type of work you want done. And unless you're a three-letter agency of the government, of the U.S. government, and have lots of money, we wouldn't even be able to consider it for the next year or two.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about that, the real guys, the guys that are the scientists and the leaders, the senior leaders, were interested in this stuff, which tells you that they believe that it's possible, that it's all true. And they were willing to go to bat for me, who, you know, I'm a nobody, but I had access to this material, and it was like, we would love to know what the answer is.
Mm-hmm. Was General McCasland, does that name sound familiar? Was he one of those people that you spoke with?
No, I only went through the civilians.
Okay.
I did not know McCasland. I think he was AFRL director after I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that I was dealing with were senior leaders when I was there from up until 2011. They had since retired, and they were now, you know, pursuing other interests. But McCasland, and I'll get on that topic if you think that's important later.
Well, that would be fun, especially if you have any insights. But the other question would be the material. Was this, because I know he's got two types. One is kind of like a rock type material. The other one is an aluminum type of material. Which was it that you were trying to have tested?
Well, I didn't receive any of the material, so I need to make that clear. I don't want people breaking into my home looking for material. It was if I could make the arrangement, then he would send me stuff. And it would be really anything of my choosing, because Art has been very generous with his information, and he knew I was going to put a story about it in my book, and he wanted to make sure that I had all the proper narrative. In fact, Art donated dozens of photographs, of which a couple are in the book. So it was, you know, the flat aluminum stuff. It was the honeycomb material. It would have been part of the I-beam. Anything I would have asked for, I think Art would have delivered to me just so he could have it tested.
Cool. Yeah, great. I mean, I know I had someone I knew do some testing, and unfortunately it did not turn out positive. But as far as anything unworldly, but it's fascinating. Well, first of all, that there could be material still there. But second of all, your experience, it's really cool that, you know, and it's telling that these people were willing to analyze something, or at least willing to run it up the flagpole for you.
Yeah, because you've got the, you know, official public affairs stance, and they have to go according to the corporate party line that there's nothing to it. It's not of defense significance. There's no technology, you know, just blowing it off. And we all understand the reason why they say that. And that's because, you know, imagine if I gave you a job that you could not do. And I said, Alejandro, today and forevermore, you're going to be doing brain surgery. Well, right. You couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. You know, that's a very skilled thing. And now we're telling the Air Force, well, you got to keep the skies clear of these things that are doing these crazy maneuvers and, you know, are taking people away and are abducting people and are seen documented 1,000 times. Well, I'm now giving them a job they can't possibly do. So the best thing that they can do for themselves is to go, it doesn't exist. You know, those droids are not the ones you're looking for.
Right.
And so we all realize why they have to do that. But now peel back and look at the people who actually were senior leaders in research and development. They're going, hell yeah, you know, if I got a chance to test this stuff, I would love to know what it is, because they're not the public face of the Air Force. Mm-hmm. You know, they're scientists and engineers.
And that's a great way to put it. And because I think that's what the media, the mainstream, does not understand, is just because the official stance is that they don't look into things or they don't think much of it. Like you said, that's coming from the PR department. But so many actual individuals in these areas, the types of people that really they would be interested in hearing from, are interested, even if they don't want to share that publicly.
Oh, most definitely. And I can tell that when I do a local presentation here in the Dayton area, and I see some, you know, folks that I used to work with or people that come up to me and say, hey, I'm a, you know, current member of Air Force Research Labs or whatever, you know, some techie kind of organization. And I found your information fascinating. You know, I've always heard it, you know, from day one when I've come on the base. And we're talking, you know, decades after I showed up, that UFO, ET, Roswell DNA is still there on the base. And so these people are interested because from the public affairs Air Force people, they're getting nothing. They're getting a wall of silence. Mm-hmm. And there's, it's very rare. I think I'm probably the only executive level person who's ever come forward with a book on the topic.
Mm-hmm. Now, on this topic, like, have you had, since, you know, that original meeting in 1973, other kind of aha moments, moments where that are really impactful, that, that change your worldview, perhaps a moment like where you, when you came to the conclusion that, hey, this probably is extraterrestrial in nature?
In 2011, it was the first week of December, I was coming home from a physical therapy appointment because my traffic accident was on the 16th of November in 2010. So now it's early December. It's just over a year later, and I'm coming back from the therapist's office, and I'm within a half mile of home. It was one of those overcast days. The ceiling was about 75 feet, and something caught my eye through the sunroof in my car. Now the shield was pulled back, the window was closed, and I don't know what it was, a shadow, a glint, something. And then I looked down underneath through my windshield, and out in front of me was a large metallic craft sliding into the cloud bank. So it was about 90 to 100 feet in width. It was silvery. It looked angular. The backside looked like the back end of a 60s Chevrolet. And I actually described that. I have the narrative. And I took a photograph of the location where my car was coming to a halt at a stoplight and where I saw it. And I used the graphics program to draw in the backside of the craft to give the reader what it would have looked like to me as I sat there, and I described the whole narrative. And this was in 2011. Now, an interesting side to that. So I saw a craft. Imagine. Now, this was, again, December of 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Based upon the short 7 to 8 seconds I saw it and the direction it was heading in, I drew a line back from the back end of the craft, and I drew it back a few miles, and the line goes directly across the main runway at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
And more interesting, somebody pointed out that there is a major building owned by the Foreign Technology Division, now NASIC, the National Air and Space Intelligence Center, that had I drawn the line back a couple more hundred feet, the line would have gone directly over that building.
Mm-hmm. What does that say to you?
Well, that says to me that I saw a craft 75 feet off the deck and 200 feet in front of me. So it was a close encounter that I didn't ask for, that I didn't. But it says to me that, you know, we probably still have things on this base that the visitors are trying to keep an eye on. And it maybe we still have a piece of their craft somewhere in one of our buildings. Maybe we still have one of the, you know, astronauts that visited us in 1947 or in one of those other recovery incidents that we all know about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that must have been. Was that your first sighting?
In 2009, I was up in Michigan. And I was, it was early in the morning, and I was tracing satellites. There's a website called Heavens Above. And if you get onto the site, it tells you when the space station's coming over and all the other things. So you can watch them. It tells you the magnitude of the brilliance. And I was looking for a satellite that was supposedly a reconnaissance satellite. I forget the number. It was like USA 242. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, it pops up exactly where it's supposed to be. And then I noticed that the satellite had company. And there were two brilliant lights about 50 times the magnitude of what I was seeing from the satellite. And they were in a synchronous flight path with the satellite. So I'm looking, you know, 100 miles, but clearly the distinction is like looking at two acetylene torches next to like a pinpoint of light.
Wow.
And I watched it for about 25 seconds. And of course, I filed a report in the National UFO Reporting Center. So that was my first, you know, anomalous lights in the sky kind of thing. And it was so demanding of my attention that I actually filed a report with Peter Davenport's organization. And it wasn't until, so that was like 2009. So now fast forward 2 years later, almost 2.5 years later, is when I saw the up close and personal thing. So basically, two incidents. One, lights in the sky. The second was the up close and personal in my own neighborhood.
How cool. So, yeah, let's get into, you said you had more to say about General McCaslin. Is it him in particular you wanted to say something about, or the idea of anybody in the military coming forward from Wright-Patterson?
Well, I have read the work that the rock musician has been doing, and the research, and he's quoting all of these high-ranking military members coming forward and opening these doors and giving them all this information. And, you know, one of the guys that he quotes has an axe to grind. You know, the one guy he quotes got fired. He was demoted basically in his retirement because he had not had enough time at his higher grade, so they backed off his retirement. The guy was apparently fired, from what I've read, you know, for behavior that was unacceptable. And, you know, you would think that a guy who was fired, you know, he was a two-star, demoted to a one-star, and he had a lot of responsibility, he might be a little bit angry at his former bosses and, you know, would try to make their lives miserable by outing what he knew about UFOs and extraterrestrials, or, you know, claiming that. So that kind of guy, you know, I might lean towards accepting him saying a few things, but when I look at McCaslin,
I just wanted to clarify, is this person you're referring to Michael Carey, the one who worked with Space Command?
I believe that's the gentleman's name,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, sorry.
So now we get to McCaslin, and from what I know about the guy who heads Air Force Research Labs, they don't really have to and generally do not get into the nuts and bolts of what's going on. You know, they and their staff are interfacing with Senate investigations of, you know, why do we have so many laboratories, you know, defending the lab's turf, looking for new money, creating synergistic relationships with other tech efforts in different countries. So there's a lot of high level handshaking and grooming and schmoozing going on and, you know, developing high level plans and that kind of thing. That's what directors do. And I cross-checked this recently with people who do security things. And they were actually – some of the people I cross-checked with are actually security people in Air Force Research Labs. So it's as close to the truth as I could possibly get without being annoying.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked them specifically, hey, tell me about this thing that's going on with McCaslin. What's your take on it? And the couple of guys I talked to said – it just doesn't sound right, basically, from the things I just told you about what a director normally does. And the fact that if this was something that was extraterrestrial, McCaslin would not have had the need to know. You know, he might have found out about it in a former job, but for what AFRL was doing, he probably wasn't served that up on a silver platter, wasn't told about it, didn't have the need to know, most likely didn't have the need to know. And therefore, if he's talking about right pad and extraterrestrial connection and he's trying to talk facts, I'm really skeptical about that whole story.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense to me, too, because for a couple reasons. First of all, you get the sense in the communications that we know from McCaslin, who for people who don't remember, and I say remember because we've talked so much about it on this show in particular, but he's the one who ran Air Force Labs at Wright-Patterson more recently. But he talks at a higher level. It seems like he's talking more along the lines of helping Tom DeLonge get kids interested in science rather than any details, whereas it's Tom DeLonge who has claimed he's received some details, but also from Colonel Halt at Rendlesham. You've talked about the Rendlesham case, and Colonel Halt was the deputy base commander in 1980 when the UFO events occurred and became a witness. But as he says, when I've asked him about, you know, these ideas of somebody coming on the base and debriefing some of those witnesses without his knowledge, he said certainly that, you know, as a base commander or a deputy base commander, they're running the base. They don't know all the details of every project going on, and they're not read into, and they don't have clearance for all of the projects going on their base. They're running the base. So people are coming in and out from other departments and doing things that they're unaware of. So that would ring too, that as an administrator, McCaslin would be more so high level involved with bureaucracy and politics that he probably wouldn't be getting into the and details of some of these projects.
Absolutely. Agree 100%. So when I hear somebody saying, well, you know, this guy is giving me all these intimate factoids, I just find it doubtful. I'd be great if I was proven wrong, but I just find it very doubtful. And he doesn't seem to me to be a guy who has an axe to grind, you know?
Yeah.
We do things for three reasons, right? Money, sex, and revenge. Well, unlike the guy who got fired, you know, revenge is a good motive for him. McCaslin, I just don't see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Although, yeah, we don't know who's going to be saying what as time goes on. So we'll see, or if. So we'll see what happens there. But it is interesting that they're engaging in conversation at such high levels on this topic. But as you say, you know, this happens more often than people may know.
That's true, especially in the case where I was going to get the material from Wade and Campbell, and the guys who were former directors of laboratories said, hey, this would be a great idea. I'd love to hear what the answer is.
Mm-hmm. So before we're done, it's about time for us to start wrapping up. In your book, you know, is there an aspect or some of your book that we haven't talked about that you think it's really important for people to know to interest them in purchasing it?
Great. Can I mention the name of my book?
For sure. Yeah, I mentioned it at the beginning of the show, but mention it as much as you like.
Okay. The name of the book is 50 Shades of Grays: Evidence of Extraterrestrial Visitation to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and Beyond. And that's a lengthy title. The first part of it was just to attract attention and to springboard off of, you know, the famous title. And fortunately, you can't copyright a title. So, you know, there we have it. But I think one of the interesting discoveries I've made, I'll mention two of them quickly. The first is that I had two Men in Black encounters at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Hmm.
And if you look in my book, you'll find a photograph of the individual with whom I had those encounters. And I actually had
somewhat – You mean the man in black or someone who was with you?
I have a photograph in my book of a man in black. He is dressed as a man in black. He looks like a man in black. Uh-huh. And he talks like a man in black.
Uh-huh.
And he works for – intelligence agency, which isn't hosted at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, probably is a duck.
Oh, you cut out there for a second. So, which intelligence agency or just N?
Ah, that's funny. So I cut out just when I was going to say the name of the intelligence agency.
Yeah.
Formerly FTD, now NASIC, the National Air and Space Intelligence Center. So I basically talked with him while he was standing on the campus of the intelligence agency.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Interesting.
So that discovery of the fact that, you know, if he's parading around, he's either too early or too late for Halloween. And who dresses like that anyway?
Uh-huh.
So the fact that, you know, this guy is, you know, looking like a man in black and, in fact, asks me about Area 51, if I've ever been there and would I like to see it?
Hmm.
And again, this whole narrative is included in the book. So I think that's one very important discovery, along with the fact that many other intelligence agencies have offices on that campus. And so I asked the question, don't men in black have to be somewhere during the day?
Mm-hmm.
The other interesting thing that I think readers will find is there are several ancient Adena burial ground sites at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Five mounds are at the Wright Brothers Memorial, and that's publicly accessible.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sixth one, which is in Area B, of which there are three areas at Wright-Patterson, in Area B, and it's the most pronounced mound. It was examined in a non-intrusive manner using ground-penetrating radar back in the 90s. And what I've discovered in a report that was written on that non-destructive investigation, there are two metal objects in that mound that are approximately a half a meter long.
Hmm.
Well, the ancient Adena culture, the largest piece of metal that they had in their hands were copper axe heads. And if nobody disturbed that mound, and supposedly it was undisturbed or disturbed minimally, why do we find two large metal blocks in the ancient Adena burial mound? And I posit, and you know, I'm opening it for up to debate, that if we took a casket and put a 4-foot alien in it and we put it upside down, we inserted it straight into the ground, I might get a cross section that is a half meter by a half a meter. And why not put aliens that we're done using, we no longer need them for science, we're going to inter them because that's what we do with dead bodies. Why not put them in the site that A, nobody can get to because it's protected by federal law, and B, it would be ceremonial. It would be significant from that perspective because we would reunite these ancient astronauts with the oldest civilization at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which was the Adena culture. And that whole narrative and photographs of that site are contained in the book.
Cool. Interesting. Very, very interesting stuff. So, yeah, this is great. I'm very excited about the book. I have not got to read it yet. I could swear I had a copy. I don't know.
I sent one to you.
I can't find it. I've been looking for it. I know it's got to be around here somewhere. And I even checked at home thinking maybe I took it home because I wanted to read it because I have wanted to look at it. So I can't. It disappeared. The Men in Black came and stole it. So
Offline, send me your address. I'll send you another one.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And if I find the other one, I'll definitely get it to people to read. Where is the best place for people to go to purchase the book?
The only place they can get it is online at Amazon.
Okay. All right. So 50 Shades of Grey and your last name, if they're looking for you, Ray is Szymanski, spelled Szymanski.
That's perfect. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate it.
So what's up for you next? Are you going to work on another book, doing some more research?
Yes, I have two books actually in the works.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really exciting. Did you want to give us a clue as to what those are about?
Yeah, the second book is about contact.
Mm-hmm.
Alien contact, and it seems like every time I do a presentation, two or three people say, I've got to tell you my story, and I've been just collecting a whole bunch of new friends who have wonderful stories that I'm, you know, trying to corroborate through witnesses and, you know, my general kind of research. So that's the next book I'd like to put out, is all about contact and give these people a voice. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, you know, maybe I'll come up with something new. And then the third and final book, because I've decided I'm only going to do three, is more in the vein of what I did the first time around. I obviously could not fit all of the research and discoveries into a first book because there's a practical limit to it. So about 250 pages is the practical limit. And I have other stories, great photographs, other narratives that I just had to terminate. I just couldn't include in the first book. So I want to kind of get back to that after I do this contact ebook.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Sounds exciting. Well, great. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. This has been a lot of fun, and I'm sure people are really going to enjoy the book.
Well, I hope we get to talk again soon.
All right. Talk to you later.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much to Ray for being on the show. That is Ray Shemansky. And I keep saying Shemansky because I like the name and it's fun to say, but also because it doesn't, the spelling is different. So it's spelled S-Z-Y-M-A-N-S-K-I. So S-Z-Y is the way it is. So if you're Googling Ray, but of course, 50 Shades of Grays is a little bit easier to remember. So if you put 50 Shades of Grays, UFO, or something like that, you're going to find it. Or if you go to openminds.tv and you look at the description here of this interview, you'll see a link to the book there as well. So a number of ways to be able to purchase the book, which I recommend people doing because it sounds very, very interesting, and I am very excited to read it myself. So lots of good books out there, huh? So if you haven't finished the Leslie Cain book from talking about it last week, you know, finish that up and then order Ray's book, and you'll have another book to read there. So cool stuff. Thank you very much to Ray for being on the show. Thank you to Martin Willis for helping us with the news at the beginning of the show. Remember, you can read all those stories that we talk about at openminds.tv. The Roger Marsh, you know, MUFON reports are something that we post on pretty much a daily basis. And the UFO headlines is something else we also do on a daily basis, unless I'm at the beach and either cannot get internet access or just don't want to because I want to be on the beach. So unless any of those situations are happening or we're doing a conference, then I'm posting UFO news on a daily basis, the headlines. And we have really interesting headlines today with those high school kids who saw the UFO. They're not high school kids anymore, but they were back in Australia. And then also the police officers in Montana who had their own UFO sighting that made it into the news that we talked about earlier. So really cool stuff. So be sure to check that out. A couple other things I want you to check out. First of all, on our YouTube channel, we posted a Phoenix Lights video that is really cool. You're going to want to check that out. It's got some local Phoenix MUFON people talking there. We actually played pieces of this throughout the conference just to you know, keep with that Phoenix Lights theme. It's also got the lady who runs the Arizona Heritage Center, which is this big, huge building with this beautiful museum that is owned by the Arizona Historical Society, and they have a Phoenix Lights display there. So it's a great video. We're very proud of it. We're going to have a couple other great videos coming up very soon. So this week, I want to post my latest talk at the local Phoenix MUFON, which is about international UFO organizations. So that's like a two-hour talk I'm going to put up on YouTube for free. And then we've also got some other stuff. We're probably going to do one other Phoenix Lights post since it is a 20th anniversary before we move on from the Phoenix Lights. But of course, it's a very important thing out here and one of the most important sightings. So that's why we're paying so much attention to it. Otherwise, we have a lot of exciting stuff brewing. Lots of really cool stuff. And so stick with us because, as usual, we're going to have lots of cool stuff throughout the year. And yay, I was able to get a show up today. I'll bet you some of you were like, oh, he's never going to do it. He's got a couple days to do it. Oh, man, he's probably just going to go to the beach. He likes being at the beach so much. Why does he go live there? Ugh. Well, for you people who say that, you're right. I do love the beach, and I hope to live by the beach one day. And I do prefer the beach to being on the internet and doing UFO stuff. But I can't always be on the beach, so gosh darn it, that means I got to do UFO stuff. But hey, at least I'm doing it right. But yeah, I was able to get organized enough to get this show out. So very happy to do that because I do love doing these shows and sharing this information. And Ray had some fun stuff. And I will do my best to have shows out on a weekly basis as much as possible. Otherwise, what else is there? I don't know. That's it, guys and girls. I guess my final thank yous and wrap up, right? So my final thank you goes out to Caleb Hanks, who does the opening and close music for this show. I also want to thank you, the listeners, because you're so awesome. And I just love you guys. And thank you so much for joining me every week, most every week, for Open Mind UFO Radio. Until next week, adios muchachos.